A sudden vision of a moonlit seafront. Laughter. The clinking of glasses. She closed her eyes, willing the fleeting image to become clear.
I thought we might drive down this time. Just the two of us.
It was gone. She could hear her pulse in her ears. Stay calm, she told herself. It will all come. Mr. Hargreave said it would.
You always seem happy there. Perhaps a little happier there than in London.
He glanced up at her and then away. There it was again, the feeling that she was being tested. She forced herself to chew and swallow. Whatever you think best, she said quietly. The room fell silent but for the slow scraping of his cutlery on his plate, an oppressive sound. Her food suddenly appeared insurmountable. Actually, I'm more tired than I thought. Would you mind terribly if I went upstairs? He stood as she got to her feet.
I should have told Mrs. Cordoza a kitchen supper would suffice. Would you like me to help you up?
Please, don't fuss. She waved away the offer of his arm. I'm just a little tired. I'm sure I'll be much better in the morning. At 9:45, she heard him enter the room. She had lain in the bed, acutely aware of the sheets around her, the moonlight that sliced through the long curtains, the distant sounds of traffic in the square, of taxis slowing to disgorge their occupants, a polite greeting from someone walking a dog. She had kept very still, waiting for something to click into place, for the ease with which she had fitted back into her physical environment to seep into her mind. And then the door had opened. He did not turn on the light. She heard the soft clash of wooden hangers as he hung up his jacket, the soft vacuum thuck of his shoes being pulled from his feet. And suddenly she was rigid. Her husband, this man, this stranger, was going to climb into her bed. She had been so focused on getting through each moment that she hadn't considered it. She had half expected him to sleep in the spare room. She bit down on her lip, her eyes tight shut, forcing her breathing to stay slow in semblance of sleep. She heard him disappear into the bathroom, the sluice of the tap, vigorous brushing of teeth and a brief gargle. His feet padded back across the carpeted floor, and then he was sliding between the covers, causing the mattress to dip and the bedstead to creak in protest. For a minute he lay there, and she fought to maintain her even breaths. "Oh, please, not yet," she willed him. "I hardly know you."
"Jenny," he said.
She felt his hand on her hip, forced herself not to flinch. He moved it tentatively.
"Jenny."
She made herself let out a long breath, conveying the blameless oblivion of deep sleep. She felt him pause, his hand still, and then with a sigh of his own, he lay back heavily on his pillows.
"I wish I could be the person that saves you, but it's just not going to happen. I won't call you after you get this letter, because that might upset you, and that won't be a fair reflection of you if I hear you cry, because I've never seen you cry in a year and a half, and I've never had a girlfriend like that before."
Male to female, via letter. Chapter 2 Moira Parker regarded the grim set of her boss's jawline, the determined way in which he strode through her office to his own, and thought it was probably a good thing that Mr. Arbuthnot, his 2:30, was late. Clearly the last meeting had not gone well. She stood up, smoothing her skirt, and took his coat, which was speckled with rain from the short walk between his car and the office. She placed his umbrella in the stand, then took a moment longer than usual to hang the coat carefully on the hook. She had worked for him long enough now to judge when he needed a little time alone. She poured him a cup of tea. He always had a cup of tea in the afternoons, two cups of coffee in the mornings. Collected up her papers with an economy born of years' practice, then knocked on his door and walked in. "I suspect Mr. Arbuthnot has been held up in traffic. Apparently there's a big jam on the Marylebone Road." He was reading the letters she had left on his desk earlier for his signature. Evidently satisfied, he took his pen from his breast pocket and signed with short, abrupt strokes. She placed his tea on his desk and folded the letters into her pile of papers.
"I've picked up the tickets for your flight to South Africa and arranged for you to be collected at the airport."
"That's the 15th.
"Yes. I'll bring them through if you'd like to check the paperwork. Here are the sales figures for last week. The latest wage totals are in this folder here. And as I wasn't sure you would have had time for lunch after the car manufacturer's meeting, I've taken the liberty of ordering you some sandwiches. I hope that's acceptable."
"Very kind, Moira. Thank you."
"Would you like them now, with your tea?" He nodded and smiled at her briefly. She did her best not to colour. She knew the other secretaries mocked her for what they considered her over-attentive manner with her boss, not to mention her prim clothes and slightly stiff way of doing things. But he was a man who liked things done properly, and she had always understood that. Those silly girls, with their heads always stuck in a magazine, their endless gossiping in the ladies' cloakroom, they didn't understand the inherent pleasure in a job well done. They didn't understand the satisfaction of being indispensable. She hesitated briefly, then pulled the last letter from her folder.
"The second post has arrived. I thought you should probably see this. It's another of those letters about the men at Rochdale."
His eyebrows lowered, which killed the small smile that had illuminated his face. He read the letter twice.
"Has anyone else seen this?"
"No, sir."
"File it with the others."
He thrust it at her.
"It's all troublemaking stuff. The unions are behind it. I won't have any truck with them."
She took it, wordlessly. She made as if to leave, then turned back.
"And may I ask, how is your wife? Glad to be back at home, I should say."
"She's fine, thank you. Much, much more her old self," he said. "It's been a great help for her to be at home."
She swallowed. "I'm very pleased to hear it." His attention was already elsewhere. He was flicking through the sales figures she had left for him. Her smile still painted on her face, Moira Parker clasped her paperwork to her chest and marched back out to her desk. "Old friends," he had said, "nothing too challenging." Two of those friends were familiar now, having visited Jennifer in hospital and again once she had returned home. Yvonne Moncrief, an elongated, dark-haired woman in her early 30s, had been her friend since they had become close neighbours in Medway Square. She had a dry, sardonic manner, which stood in direct contrast to that of the other friend, Violet, whom Yvonne had known at school and seemed to accept the other's cutting humour and droll put-downs as her due. Jennifer had struggled initially to catch the shared references, to gauge any significance from the names they bandied between them. But she had felt at ease in their company. She was learning to trust her gut reactions to people. Memories could be lodged in places other than the mind.
"I wish I could lose my memory," Yvonne had said when Jennifer had confessed how strange she had felt on waking up in hospital.
"I'd walk off into the sunset, forget I ever married Francis in the first place."
She'd popped over to reassure Jennifer that all was in order. It was to be a quiet dinner party. But as the afternoon had worn on, Jennifer had become almost paralysed with nerves.
"I don't know why you're flapping, darling. Your parties are legendary."
She perched on the bed as Jennifer wriggled in and out of a succession of dresses.
"Yes, but for what?"
She tried to rearrange her bust inside a dress. She seemed to have lost a little weight in hospital, and the front puckered unattractively.
Yvonne laughed. "Oh, relax. You don't have to do a thing, Jenny. The marvellous Mrs. C. will have done you proud. The house looked beautiful. You look stunning. Or at least you will if you put some damn clothes on."
She kicked off her shoes and lifted her long, elegant legs onto the bed.
"I've never understood your enthusiasm for entertaining. Don't get me wrong, I do love going to parties, but all that organising..."
She was examining her nails.
"Parties are for going to, not for having. That's what my mother said, and frankly, it still stands. I'll buy myself a new dress or two, but
canapes and seating plans. Ugh!
Jennifer wrestled the neckline into shape and stared at herself in the mirror, turning to the left, then the right. She held out her arm. The scar was raised and still angrily pink.
Do you think I should wear long sleeves?
Yvonne sat up and peered at her.
Does it hurt?
My whole arm aches, and the doctor gave me some pills. I just wondered whether the scar would be a bit...
distracting.
Yvonne's nose wrinkled.
You probably would do better in long sleeves, darling, just until it fades a little. And it's so cold.
Jennifer was startled by her friend's blunt assessment, but not offended. It was the first straightforward thing anyone had said to her since she had come home. She stepped out of the dress, went to her wardrobe and rifled through it until she found a sheath dress in raw silk. She pulled it off the rail and gazed at it. It was so flashy. Since she had been at home, she had wanted to hide in tweed, subtle greys and brown. Yet these jewelled dresses kept leaping out at her.
"Is this the kind of thing?"
she said.
"What kind of thing?"
Jennifer took a deep breath.
"That I used to wear. Is this how I used to look?"
She held the dress against herself. Yvonne pulled a cigarette from her bag and lit it, studying Jennifer's face.
"Are you telling me you really don't remember anything?"
Jennifer sat on the stool in front of her dressing table.
"Pretty much,"
she admitted.
I know you, just like I know him. I can feel it here."
She tapped her chest.
"But it's... there are huge gaps. I don't remember how I felt about my life. I don't know how I'm meant to behave with anyone. I don't..."
She chewed the side of her lip.
"I don't know who I am."
Unexpectedly, her eyes filled with tears. She pulled open one drawer, then another, searching for a handkerchief. Yvonne waited a moment. Then she stood up, walked over, and sat down with her on the narrow stool.
"All right, darling, I'll fill you in. You're lovely and funny and full of joie de vivre. You have the perfect life, the rich, handsome husband who adores you, and a wardrobe any woman would die for. Your hair is always perfect. Your waist is the span of a man's hand. You're always the centre of any social gathering, and all our husbands are secretly in love with you."
"Oh, don't be ridiculous."
"I'm not. Francis adores you. Whenever he sees your minxy little smile, those blonde tresses of yours, I can see him wondering why on earth he married this lanky, cranky old Jewess. As for Bill..."
"Bill?"
"Violet's husband. Before you were married, he virtually followed you around like a lapdog. It's a good job he's so terrified of your husband, or he'd have made off with you under his arm years ago."
Jennifer wiped at her eyes with a handkerchief.
"You're being very kind." "Not at all. If you weren't so nice, I'd have to have you bumped off. But you're lucky. I like you."
They sat together for a few minutes. Jennifer rubbed at a spot on the carpet with her toe.
"Why don't I have children?"
Yvonne took a long drag on her cigarette. She glanced at Jennifer and arched her eyebrows.
"The last time we spoke about it, you remarked that to have children, it's usually advisable for husband and wife to be on the same continent for a while. He's away an awful lot, your husband."
She smirked, exhaled a perfect smoke ring.
"It's one of the other reasons I've always been horribly envious of you."
As Jennifer gave a reluctant chuckle, she continued,
"Oh, you'll be fine, darling. You should do what that ridiculously expensive doctor said and stop fretting. You'll probably have some eureka moment in a couple of weeks and remember everything. Disgusting, snoring husband, the state of the economy, the awful size of your account in Harvey Nichols. In the meantime, enjoy your innocence while it lasts."
"I suppose you're right."
"And having said that, I think you should wear the rose pink thing. You have a quartz necklace that goes fabulously with it. The emerald doesn't do you any favours. It makes your bust look like two deflated balloons."
"Oh, you are a friend," Jennifer said, and the two laughed. The door had slammed, and he had dropped his briefcase on the hall floor, the chill air of outside on his overcoat and skin. He took off his scarf, kissed Yvonne, and apologised for his lateness.
"Accountants meeting. You know how these money men go on."
"Oh,
You should see them when they get together, Larry. Bores me to tears. We've been married 5 years and I still couldn't tell you the difference between a debit and a credit. Yvonne checked her watch. He should be here soon. No doubt some unmissable column of figures to wave his magic wand over.
He faced his wife.
You look very fetching, Jenny.
Doesn't she? Your wife always scrubs up rather well.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Right.
He ran a hand across his jawline.
If you'll both excuse me, I'll go and freshen up before our other guests arrive. It's going to snow again. I heard the weather forecast on the wireless.
We'll have a drink waiting for you,
Yvonne called. By the time the door opened a second time, Jennifer's nerves had been dulled by a potent cocktail.
It will be fine, she kept telling herself.
Yvonne would step in with prompts if she was about to make a fool of herself. These were her friends. They wouldn't be waiting for her to trip up. They were another step to bringing her back to herself.
Jenny, thank you so much for asking us.
Violet Fairclough gave her a hug, her plump face almost submerged in a turban. She unpinned it from her head and handed it over with her coat. She was wearing a scoop-necked silk dress, which strained like a wind-filled parachute around her ample contours. Violet's waist, as Yvonne would later remark, would require the hands of a small infantry company to span it.
"Jennifer, a picture of loveliness as always."
A tall, red-headed man stooped to kiss her. Jennifer was astonished by the unlikeliness of this coupling. She didn't remember the man at all, and found it almost funny that he should be little Violet's husband.
"Do come through," she said, tearing her eyes off him and recovering her composure. "My husband will be down in a few minutes. Let me get you a drink in the meantime."
"My husband, eh? Are we terribly formal this evening?"
Bill laughed.
"Well," Jennifer faltered, "as it's been so long since I've seen you."
"Beast, you've got to be kind to Jenny."
Yvonne kissed him.
"She's still terribly fragile. She should be reclining upstairs consumptively, while we select one man at a time to peel her a grape."
"But she would insist on martinis." "Now that's the Jenny we know and love."
Bill's smile of appreciation was so lingering that Jennifer glanced twice at Violet to make sure she wasn't offended. She didn't seem to mind. She was rummaging in her handbag.
"I've left your number with a new nanny," she said, glancing up. "I hope you don't mind. She really is the most useless woman. I fully expect her to be calling here at any minute to say she can't get Frederick's pajama bottoms on, or some such."
Jennifer caught Bill rolling his eyes, and with a flash of dismay, realized that the gesture was familiar to her. There were 8 around the table. Her husband and Francis at either end, Yvonne, Dominic, who was quite high up in the horse guards, and Jennifer sat along the window side, with Violet, Bill and Anne, Dominic's wife, opposite. Anne was a cheerful sort, guffawing at the men's jokes with a benign twinkle in her eye that spoke of a woman comfortable in her skin. Jennifer found herself watching them as they ate, analysing and examining with forensic detail the things they said to each other, seeking out the clues to their past life. Bill, she noted, rarely looked at his wife, let alone addressed her. Violet seemed oblivious to this, and Jennifer wondered whether she was unaware of his indifference or just stoic in hiding her embarrassment. Yvonne, for all her joking complaints about Francis, watched him constantly. She delivered her jokes at his expense, while directing at him a smile of challenge. "This is how they are together," Jennifer thought. "She won't show him how much he means to her."
"I wish I'd put my money in refrigerators," Francis was saying. "The newspaper was saying this morning that there should be 1 million of the things sold in Britain this year. 1 million. 5 years ago, that was 170,000.
"In America, it must be 10 times that. I heard people exchange them every couple of years."
Violet speared a piece of fish.
"And they're huge. Double the size of ours. Can you imagine?"
"Everything in America's bigger, or so they love to tell us. Including the egos, judging by the ones I've come up against."
Dominic's voice lifted.
You've not met an insufferable know-all until you've met a Yank general.
Anne was laughing. Poor old Dom was a bit put out when one tried to tell him how to drive his own car.
Say, your quarters are pretty small. These vehicles are pretty small. Your rations are pretty small.
Dominic mimicked.
They should have seen what it was like with rationing. Of course, they have no idea.
Dom thought he'd have some fun with him and borrowed my mother's Morris Minor. Picked him up in it. You should have seen his face.
Standard issue over here, chump, I told him. For visiting dignitaries, we use the Vauxhall Velox. Gives you that extra 3 inches of legroom. He virtually had to fold himself in two to fit inside.
I was howling with laughter, said Anne. I don't know how Dom didn't end up in the most awful trouble. How's business, Larry? I hear you're off to Africa again in a week or so.
Jennifer watched her husband settle back in his seat.
Good. Very good, in fact. I've just signed a deal with a certain motor company to manufacture brake linings.
He placed his knife and fork together on his plate.
What exactly is it you do? I'm never quite sure what this new-fangled mineral you're using is.
Don't pretend to be interested, Violet, Bill said from the other side of the table. Violet's rarely interested in anything that isn't pink or blue or starts a sentence with mama.
Perhaps, Bill, darling, that simply means there isn't enough stimulation for her at home,
Yvonne parried, and the men whistled exuberantly.
Lawrence Sterling had turned towards Violet.
It's not actually a new mineral at all, he was saying. It's been around since the days of the Romans. Did you study the Romans at school?
I certainly did. I can't remember anything about them now, of course.
Her laugh was shrill. Lawrence's voice dropped, and the table hushed for better to hear him.
Well, Pliny the Elder wrote about how he had seen a piece of cloth thrown into a banqueting hall fire and brought out again minutes later without a scrap of damage. Some people thought it was witchcraft, but he knew this was something extraordinary.
He pulled a pen from his pocket, leant forwards, and scribbled on his damask napkin. He pushed it round for her to see better.
The name of chrysotile, the most common form, is derived from the Greek words chrysos, which means gold, and tylos, fibre. Even then, they knew it had terrific value. All I do, my company, I mean, is mine it and mould it into a variety of uses.
You put out fires?
Yes.
He looked thoughtfully at his hands.
Or I make sure they don't start in the first place.
In the brief silence that followed, an atmosphere fell over the table. He glanced at Jennifer, then away.
So where's the big money, old chap? Not flame-proof tablecloths. Car parts.
He sat back in his chair, and the room seemed to relax with him.
They say that within 10 years, most households in Britain will have a car. That's an awful lot of brake linings. And we're in talks with the railways and the airlines. But the uses of white asbestos are pretty limitless. We've branched out into guttering, farm buildings, sheeting, insulation. Soon it'll be everywhere. A wonder mineral indeed.
He was at ease as he discussed his business with his friends in a way that he had not been when the two of them were alone, Jennifer thought. It must have been strange for him, too, to have her so badly injured, and even now not quite herself. She thought of Yvonne's description of her that afternoon. Gorgeous, poised, minxy. Was he missing that woman? Perhaps conscious that she was watching him, he turned his head and caught her eye. She smiled, and after a moment he smiled back.
I saw that. Come on, Larry, you're not allowed to moon at your wife.
Bill began to refill their glasses.
He certainly is allowed to moon at his wife, Francis protested, after everything that happened to her. How are you feeling now, Jenny? You look wonderful.
I'm fine, thank you.
I should think she's doing terribly well. Holding a dinner party, not a week after getting out of hospital? If Jenny wasn't giving a dinner party, I should think there was something terribly wrong. And not just with her, but the whole damn world.
Bill took a long swig of his wine.
Awful business. It's lovely to see you looking like your old self.
We were terribly worried. I hope you got my flowers, Anne put in.
Dominic laid his napkin on the table.
Do you remember anything about the accident itself, Jenny?
She'd probably prefer not to dwell on it, if you don't mind.
Lawrence stood up to fetch another bottle of wine from the sideboard.
Of course not.
Dominic lifted a hand in apology.
Thoughtless of me.
Jennifer began to collect the plates. I'm fine, really. It's just that there isn't much I could tell you. I don't remember very much at all.
Just as well, Dominic observed.
Yvonne was lighting a cigarette. Well, the sooner you're responsible for everyone's brake linings, Larry, darling, the safer we'll all be.
And the richer he'll be, Francis laughed.
Oh, Francis, darling, must we really bring every single conversation back to money?
Yes,
he and Bill answered in unison. Jennifer heard them laughing as she picked up the pile of dirty china and headed towards the kitchen.
Well, that went well, didn't it?
She was seated at her dressing table, carefully removing her earrings. She saw his reflection in the mirror as he came into the bedroom, loosening his tie. He kicked off his shoes and went into the bathroom, leaving the door open. Yes, she said. I think it did.
The food was wonderful.
Oh, I can't take any credit for that, she said. Mrs. Cordoza organized it all.
But you planned the menu.
It was easier not to disagree with him. She placed the earrings carefully inside their box. She could hear the wash basin filling with water. I'm glad you liked it. She stood up and wrestled herself out of her dress, hung it up, and began to peel off her stockings. She'd removed one when she looked up to see him standing in the doorway. He was gazing at her legs.
You looked very beautiful tonight, he said quietly.
She blinked hard, rolling off the second stocking. She reached behind her to undo her girdle, now acutely self-conscious. Her left arm was still useless, too weak to reach round to her back. She kept her head down, hearing him come towards her. He was bare-chested now, but still in his suit trousers. He stood behind her, moved her hands away and took over. He was so close that she could feel his breath on her back as he parted each hook from its eye.
Very beautiful, he repeated.
She closed her eyes. This is my husband, she told herself. He adores me. Everyone says so. We're happy. She felt his fingers running lightly along her right shoulder, the touch of his lips at the back of her neck.
Are you very tired? He murmured.
She knew this was her chance. He was a gentleman. If she said she was, he would step back, leave her alone. But they were married. Married. She had to face this sometime, and who knew? Perhaps, if he seemed less alien, she would find that a little more of herself was restored to her. She turned in his arms. She couldn't look at his face, couldn't kiss him. Not if you're not, she whispered into his chest. She felt his skin against hers and clamped her eyes shut, waiting to feel a sense of familiarity, perhaps even desire. 4 years they had been married. How many times must they have done this? And since her return he had been so patient. She felt his hands moving over her, bolder now, unclipping her brassiere. She kept her eyes closed, conscious of her appearance. May we turn out the light, she said. I don't want to be thinking about my arm, how it looks.
Of course, I should have thought.
She heard the click of the bedroom light, but it wasn't her arm that bothered her. She didn't want to look at him, didn't want to be so exposed, vulnerable, under his gaze. And then they were on the bed, and he was kissing her neck, his hands, his breath, urgent. He lay on top of her, pinning her down, and she linked her arms around his neck, unsure what she should be doing in the absence of any feelings she might have expected. What has happened to me? She thought. What used I to do?
Are you all right? He murmured into her ear. I'm not hurting you.
No, she said. No, not at all. He kissed her breasts, a low moan of pleasure escaping him. take them off, he said, pulling at her knickers. He shifted his weight off her, so that she could tug them down to her knees, then kick them away. And she was exposed. Perhaps if we... she wanted to say, but he was already nudging her legs apart, trying clumsily to guide himself into her. I'm not ready. But couldn't say that. It would be wrong now. He was lost somewhere else, desperate, wanting. She grimaced, drawing up her knees, trying not to tense. And then he was inside her, and she was biting her cheek in the dark, trying to ignore the pain, and that she felt nothing, except a desperate desire for it to be over and him out of her. His movements built in speed and urgency, his weight squashing her, his face hot and damp against her shoulder. And then, with a little cry, a hint of vulnerability he did not show in any other part of his life, it was over, and the thing was gone, replaced by a sticky wetness between her thighs. She had bitten the inside of her cheek so hard that she could taste blood. He rolled off her, still breathing hard. "Thank you," he said, into the darkness. She was glad he couldn't see her lying there, gazing at nothing, the covers pulled up to her chin. "That's quite all right," she said quietly. She had discovered that memories could indeed be lodged in places other than the mind.
Happy days are not to be. It really isn't you, it's me.
Male to female, via postcard. Chapter 3.
A profile of an industrialist.
Don Franklin's stomach threatened to burst over the top of his trousers. The buttons strained, revealing, above his belt, a triangle of pale, pelted skin. He leant back in his chair and tilted his glasses to the top of his head.
It's the editor's must, O'Hare. He wants a four-page spread on the Wonder Mineral for the advertising. What the hell do I know about mines and factories? I'm a foreign correspondent, for Christ's sake. You were, Don corrected. We can't send you out again, Anthony, you know that. And I need someone who can do a nice job. You can't just sit around here making the place look untidy.
Anthony slumped in the chair on the other side of the desk and drew out a cigarette. Behind the news editor, who was just visible through the glass wall of his office, Phipps, the junior reporter, ripped three sheets of paper from his typewriter, and face screwed up in frustration, replaced them, with two sheets of carbon between.
I've seen you do this stuff. You can turn on the charm. So, not even a profile. A puff piece. Glorified advertising. It's part-based in Congo. You know about the country. I know about the kind of man who owns mines in Congo.
Don held out his hand for a cigarette. Anthony gave him one and lit it.
It's not all bad. No. You get to interview this guy at his summer residence in the south of France, the Riviera. A few days in the sun, a lobster or two on expenses, maybe a glimpse of Brigitte Bardot. You should be thanking me. Send Peterson. He loves all that stuff. Peterson's covering the Norwich child killer. Murfitt. He's a crawler. Murfitt's off to Ghana to cover the trouble in Ashanti. Him?
Anthony was incredulous.
He couldn't cover two schoolboys fighting in a telephone box. How the hell's he doing Ghana?
He lowered his voice.
Send me back, Don. No. I could be half insane, alcoholic, and in a ruddy asylum, but I'd still do a better job than Murfitt, and you know it. Your problem, O'Hare, is that you don't know when you're well off.
Don leant forwards and dropped his voice.
Listen. Just stop crabbing and listen. When you came back from Africa, there was a lot of talk upstairs.
He motioned to the editor's suite
about whether you should be let go. The whole incident, they were worried about you, man. Anyway, God only knows how, but you've made a lot of friends here, and some fairly important ones. They took everything you've been through into account and kept you on the payroll. Even while you were in...
He gestured awkwardly behind him.
You know.
Anthony's gaze was level.
Anyhow, they don't want you doing anything too... pressured.
So get a grip on yourself, get over to France, and be grateful that you've got the kind of job that occasionally involves dining in the foothills at ruddy Monte Carlo. Who knows? You might bag a starlet while you're there.
A long silence followed. When Anthony failed to look suitably impressed, Don stubbed out his cigarette.
You really don't want to do it?
No, Don, you know I don't. I start doing this stuff, it's just a few small steps to births, marriages and deaths.
Jesus, you're a contrary bugger, O'Hare.
He reached for a piece of typewritten paper that he ripped from the spike on his desk.
Okay, then, take this. Vivian Lee's headed across the Atlantic. She's going to be camping outside the theatre where Olivia's playing. Apparently he won't talk to her, and she's telling the gossip columnist she doesn't know why. How about you find out whether they're going to divorce? Maybe get a nice description of what she's wearing while you're there.
There was another lengthy pause. Outside the room, Phipps ripped out another three pages, smacked his forehead, and mouthed expletives. Anthony stubbed out his cigarette and shot his boss a black look.
I'll go and pack, he said.
There was something about seriously rich people, Anthony thought as he dressed for dinner, that always made him want to dig at them a little. Perhaps it was the inbuilt certainty of men who were rarely contradicted, the pomposity of those whose most prosaic views everyone took so damned seriously. At first, he had found Lawrence Sterling less offensive than he had expected. The man had been courteous, his answers considered, his views on his workers pretty enlightened. But as the day had worn on, Anthony saw he was the kind of man to whom control was paramount. He spoke at people, rather than soliciting information from them. He had little interest in anything outside his own circle. He was a bore, rich and successful enough not to try to be anything else. Anthony brushed down his jacket, wondering why he had agreed to go to the dinner. Sterling had invited him at the end of the interview, and, caught off guard, he had been forced to admit that he didn't know anyone in Antibes and had no plans other than for a quick bite at the hotel. He suspected afterwards that Sterling had invited him to make it more likely that he would write something flattering. Even as he accepted reluctantly, Sterling was instructing his driver to pick him up from the hotel cab at 7:30.
"You won't find the house," he said. "It's quite well hidden from the road."
"I'll bet," Anthony had thought.
Sterling didn't seem the kind of man who would welcome casual human interaction. The concierge woke up visibly when he saw the limousine waiting outside. Suddenly, he was rushing to open the doors. The smile that had been absent on his arrival now plastered across his face. Anthony ignored him. He greeted the driver and climbed into the front passenger seat. A little, he realized afterwards, to the driver's discomfort. But in the rear he would have felt like an imposter. He wound down his window to let the warm Mediterranean breeze stroke his skin as the long, low vehicle negotiated its way along coastal roads scented with rosemary and thyme. His gaze travelled up to the purple hills beyond. He had become accustomed to the more exotic landscape of Africa and had forgotten how beautiful parts of Europe were. He made casual conversation, asked the driver about the area, who else he had driven for, what life was like for an ordinary man in this part of the country. He couldn't help it. Knowledge was everything. Some of his best leads had come from the drivers and other servants of powerful men.
"Is Mr. Sterling a good boss?" he asked.
The driver's eyes darted towards him, his demeanour less relaxed.
"He is,"
he said, in a way that suggested the conversation was closed.
"Glad to hear it,"
Anthony replied, and made sure to tip the man generously when they arrived at the vast white house. As he watched the car disappear to the back, and what must have been the garage, he felt vaguely wistful. Taciturn as he was, he would have preferred to share a sandwich and a game of cards with the driver than make polite conversation with the bored rich of the Riviera. The 18th-century house was like that of any wealthy man, oversized and immaculate,
its facade suggesting the endless attention of several staff. The graveled driveway was wide and manicured, flanked by raised flagstone paths from which no weed would dare to emerge. Its elegant windows gleamed between painted shutters. A sweeping stone staircase led visitors into a huge hallway, which already echoed with the conversation of the other diners, and was dotted with pedestals containing huge arrangements of flowers. He walked up the steps slowly, feeling the stone still warm from the fierce heat of the day's sun. There were seven other guests at dinner. The Moncriefs, friends of the Stirlings from London, the wife's gaze was frankly assessing. The local mayor, Monsieur Lafayette, with his wife and their daughter, a lithe brunette with heavily made-up eyes and a definite air of mischief. And the elderly Monsieur and Madame de Mercier, who apparently lived in the next villa. Stirling's wife was a clean-cut, pretty blonde in the Grace Kelly mould. Such women tended to have little to say of interest, having been admired for their looks all their lives. He hoped to be placed next to Mrs. Moncrief. He hadn't minded her summing him up. She would be a challenge.
"And you work for a newspaper, Mr. O'Hare?"
The elderly Frenchwoman peered up at him.
"Yes, in England."
A manservant appeared at his elbow with a tray of drinks.
"Do you have anything soft? Tonic water, perhaps?"
The man nodded and disappeared.
"What is it called?"
she asked.
"The Nation." "The Nation?" she repeated with apparent dismay. "I haven't heard of it. I have heard of the Times. That is the best newspaper, isn't it?"
"I've heard that people think so."
"Oh, Lord," he thought. "Please let the food be good."
The silver tray appeared at his elbow with a tall glass of iced tonic water. Anthony kept his gaze away from the sparkling kir the others were drinking. Instead, he tried out a little of his schoolboy French on the mayor's daughter, who replied in perfect English, with a charming French lilt.
"Too young," he thought, registering the mayor's frown.
He was gratified to find himself seated beside Yvonne Moncrief when they finally sat down. She was polite, entertaining, and completely immune to him.
"Damn the happily married."
Jennifer Stirling was on his left, turned away in conversation.
"You spend much time here, Mr. O'Hare?"
Francis Moncrief was a tall, thin man, the physical equivalent of his wife.
"No." "You're more usually tied to the City of London?"
"No, I don't cover it at all."
"You're not a financial journalist?"
"I'm a foreign correspondent. I cover trouble abroad."
"Well, Larry called it it." Moncrief laughed. "What sort of things do you write about?"
"Oh, war, famine, disease, the cheerful stuff."
"I don't think there is much cheerful about those."
The elderly Frenchwoman sipped her wine.
"For the last year I've been covering the crisis in Congo."
"Lumumba's a troublemaker,"
Stirling interjected, "and the Belgians are cowardly fools if they think the place will do anything but sink without them."
"You believe the Africans can't be trusted to manage their own affairs?"
"Lumumba was a barefoot jungle postman not 5 minutes ago. There isn't a coloured with a professional education in the whole of Congo."
He lit a cigar and blew out a plume of smoke.
"How are they meant to run the banks once the Belgians have gone? Or the hospitals? The place will become a war zone. My mines are on the Rhodesian-Congolese border, and I've already had to draft in extra security. Rhodesian security. The Congolese can no longer be trusted."
There was a brief silence. A muscle had begun to tick insistently in Anthony's jaw. Stirling tapped his cigar.
"So, Mr. O'Hare, where were you in Congo?"
"Leopoldville, mainly. Brazzaville."
"Then you know that the Congolese army cannot be controlled."
"I know that independence is a testing time for any country. And that had Lieutenant General Janssen's been more diplomatic, many lives might have been saved."
Stirling stared at him over the cigar smoke. Anthony felt he was being reassessed.
"So, you've been sucked into the cult of Lumumba, too. Another naive liberal."
His smile was icy.
"It's hard to believe that the conditions for many Africans could become any worse."
"Then you and I must differ," Sterling retorted. "I think that there are people for whom freedom can be a dangerous gift."
The room fell silent. In the distance, a motorbike whined up a hillside. Madame Lafayette reached up anxiously to smooth her hair.
"Well, I can't say I know anything about it," Jennifer Sterling observed, laying her napkin neatly on her lap.
"Too depressing," Yvonne Moncrief agreed. "I simply can't look at the newspapers some mornings. Francis reads the Sport and City pages, and I stick to my magazines. Often the news goes completely unread."
"My wife considers anything not in the pages of Vogue to not be proper news at all," Moncrief said.
The tension eased. Conversation flowed again, and the waiters refilled the glasses. The men discussed the stock market and developments on the Riviera, the influx of campers, which led the elderly couple to complain of a lowering in tone, the endless building work, and which awful newcomers had joined the British Bridge Club.
"I shouldn't worry too much," said Moncrief. "The beach huts at Monte Carlo cost £50 a week this year. I shouldn't think too many Butlins types are going to pay that."
"I heard that Elsa Maxwell proposed covering the pebbles with foam rubber, so the beach wouldn't be uncomfortable for one's feet."
"Terrible hardships one faces in this place," Anthony remarked quietly.
He wanted to leave, but that was impossible at this stage of the meal. He felt too far from where he had been, as if he had been dropped into a parallel universe. How could they be so inured to the mess, the horror of Africa, when their lives were so plainly built upon it? He hesitated for a moment, then motioned to a waiter for some wine. Nobody at the table seemed to notice.
"So, you're going to write marvellous things about my husband, are you?"
Mrs. Sterling was peering at his cuff. The second course, a platter of fresh seafood, had been laid in front of him, and she had turned towards him. He adjusted his napkin.
"I don't know. Should I? Is he marvellous?"
"He's a beacon of sound commercial practice, according to our dear friend, Mr. Moncrief. His factories are built to the highest standards. His turnover increases year after year."
"That's not what I asked you."
"No?"
"I asked you if he was marvellous."
He knew he was being spiky, but the alcohol had woken him up, made his skin prickle.
"I don't think you should ask me, Mr. O'Hare. A wife can hardly be impartial in such matters."
"Oh, in my experience, there is no one more brutally impartial than a wife."
"Do go on."
"Who else knows all her husband's faults within weeks of marrying him, and can pinpoint them regularly and from memory with forensic accuracy?"
"Your wife sounds terribly cruel. I rather like the sound of her."
"Actually, she's an immensely clever woman."
He watched Jennifer Sterling pop a prawn into her mouth.
"Really?"
"Yes. Clever enough to have left me years ago."
She passed him the mayonnaise. Then, when he didn't take it from her, she spooned a dollop onto the side of his plate.
"Does this mean you were not very marvellous, Mr. O'Hare?"
"At being married? No, I don't suppose I was. In all other respects, I am, of course, peerless. And please, call me Anthony."
It was as if he had picked up their mannerisms, their carelessly arrogant way of speaking.
"Then, Anthony, I'm sure you and my husband will get along terribly well. I believe he has a similar view of himself."
Her eyes settled on Sterling, then returned to him and lingered just long enough for him to decide she might not be as wearisome as he thought. During the main course, rolled beef with cream and wild mushrooms, he discovered that Jennifer Sterling, née Verinder, had been married for 4 years. She lived mostly in London, and her husband made numerous trips abroad to his mines. They came to the Riviera for the winter months, part of the summer, and odd holidays when London society proved dull. "It was a tight crowd here," she said, eyeing the mayor's wife opposite. "You wouldn't want to live here full time, in the goldfish bowl." These were the things, she told him, things that should have marked her out as just another rich man's overindulged wife. But he observed other things, too. That Jennifer Sterling was probably a little neglected, more clever than her position required her to be, and that she had not realized what the combination might do to her within a year or two. For now, only the hint of sadness in her eyes suggested such self-awareness. She was caught up in a never-ending but meaningless social whirl. There were no children. I've heard it said that two people must be in the same country for a while to have one. As she said this, he wondered if she was sending him a message. But she appeared guileless, amused by her situation rather than disappointed. "Do you have children, Anthony?" she inquired.
I seem to have mislaid one. He lives with my ex-wife, who does her best to make sure that I don't corrupt him.
He knew as soon as he'd said it that he was drunk. Sober, he would never have mentioned Philip. This time, he saw something serious behind her smile, as if she was wondering whether to commiserate.
"Don't,"
he willed her silently. To hide his embarrassment, he poured himself another glass of wine.
"It's fine. He..."
"In what way might you be considered a corrupting influence, Mr. O'Hare?"
Mariette, the mayor's daughter, asked from across the table.
"I suspect, mademoiselle, that I'm more likely to be corrupted," he said. "Had I not already decided to write a most flattering profile of Mr. Sterling, I should imagine I would be won over by the food and company at his table."
He paused.
"What would it take to corrupt you, Mrs. Moncrief?" he asked.
She seemed the safest person to whom he could direct this question.
"Oh, I'd be as cheap as anything. Nobody ever tried hard enough," she said. "What rot," said her husband fondly. "It took me months to corrupt you."
"Well, you had to buy me, darling. Unlike Mr. O'Hare here, you were entirely lacking in looks and charm."
She blew him a kiss.
"Whereas Jenny is entirely incorruptible. Don't you think she gives off the most terrifying air of goodness?"
"No soul on earth is incorruptible if the price is right," said Moncrief. "Even sweet Jenny."
"No, Francis. Monsieur Lafayette is our true beacon of integrity," said Jennifer, her lips twitching mischievously at the corners. She had begun to look a little giddy. "After all, there's no such thing as corruption in French politics."
"Darling, I don't think you're equipped to discuss French politics,"
Lawrence Sterling interjected. Anthony saw the faint colour that rose to her cheeks.
"I was just saying..." "Well, don't," he said lightly.
She blinked and gazed at her plate. There was a brief hush.
"I believe you are right, madame," Monsieur Lafayette said gallantly to Jennifer as he put down his glass. "However, I can tell you what a dishonest scoundrel my rival at the town hall is. At the right price, of course."
A ripple of laughter passed around the table. Mariette's foot was pressing against Anthony's under the table. On his other side, Jennifer Sterling was quietly instructing staff to clear the plates. The Moncriefs were engaged in conversation on each side of Monsieur de Marcier.
"Jesus," he thought, "what am I doing with these people? This is not my world."
Lawrence Sterling was talking emphatically to his neighbour.
"A fool," thought Anthony,
aware even as he said it that he, with his lost family, his disappearing career, his lack of riches, might more accurately fit that description. The reference to his son, Jennifer Sterling's humiliation, and the drink had conspired to darken his mood. There was only one thing for it. He motioned to the waiter for more wine. The de Marciers left shortly after 11, the Lafayettes a few minutes later. Council business in the morning, the mayor explained.
"We start earlier than you English."
He shook hands around the huge veranda to which they had retreated for coffee and brandy.
"I will be very interested to read your article, Monsieur O'Hare. It has been a pleasure." "Oh, mine, believe me."
Anthony swayed as he stood.
"I have never been more fascinated by council politics."
He was now very drunk. The words emerged from his mouth almost before he knew what he wanted to say, and he blinked hard, conscious that he had little control over how they might be received. He had almost no idea of what he had discussed over the past hour.
The mayor's eyes met Antony's for a moment. Then he relinquished his hand and turned away.
"Papa, I will stay if you don't mind. I'm sure one of these kind gentlemen will walk me home in a little while."
Mariette stared meaningfully at Antony, who gave an exaggerated nod.
"I may need your help, mademoiselle. I haven't the faintest idea where I am," he said.
Jennifer Sterling was kissing the Lafayettes. "I'll make sure she returns home safely," she said. "Thank you so much for coming." Then she said something in French that he didn't catch. The night had grown chilly, but Antony hardly felt it. He was aware of the waves lapping the shore far below, the clink of glasses, snatches of conversation as Moncrief and Sterling discussed stock markets and investment opportunities abroad. But paid little attention as he downed the excellent cognac that someone had placed in his hand. He was used to being alone in a strange land, comfortable with his own company. But tonight he felt unbalanced, irritable. He glanced at the three women, the two brunettes and the blonde. Jennifer Sterling was holding out a hand, perhaps to show off some new piece of jewellery. The other two were murmuring, their laughter breaking into the conversation. Periodically, Mariette would glance at him and smile. Was there a hint of conspiracy in it?
17, he warned himself. Too young.
He heard crickets, the women's laughter, some jazz music from deep within the house. He closed his eyes, then opened them and checked his watch. Somehow, an hour had passed. He had the disturbing feeling that he might have nodded off. Either way, it was time to go.
"I think," he said to the men as he hauled himself out of his chair, "I should probably get back to my hotel."
Lawrence Sterling rose to his feet. He was smoking an oversized cigar.
"Let me call my driver."
He turned to the house.
"No, no," Antony protested. "The fresh air will do me good. Thank you very much for a very interesting evening. Telephone my office in the morning if you need any further information. I'll be there until lunchtime. Then I leave for Africa. Unless you'd like to come and see the mines at first hand. We can always do with an old Africa hand."
"Some other time," Antony said. Sterling shook his hand, a brief, firm handshake. Moncrief followed suit, then tipped a finger to his head in mute salute. Antony turned away and headed for the garden gate. The pathway was lit by small lanterns placed in the flower beds. Ahead, he could see the lights of vessels in the black nothingness of the sea. The lowered voices carried towards him on the breeze from the veranda.
"Interesting fellow,"
Moncrief was saying, in the kind of voice that suggested he thought the opposite.
"Better than a self-satisfied prig,"
Antony muttered under his breath.
"Mr. O'Hare, would you mind if I walked with you?"
He turned unsteadily. Mariette stood behind him, clutching a little handbag, a cardigan slung around her shoulders.
"I know the way to the town. There's a cliff path we can take. I suspect you will get very lost on your own."
He stumbled on the gritty path. The girl wound her slim brown hand through his arm.
"It's lucky there's moonlight. At least we shall see our feet," she said.
They walked a little way in silence, Antony hearing the shuffle of his shoes.